the headlines this hour. Iran calls for the strengthening of a regional approach to bring peace and security to Afghanistan as Tehran hosts a conference of Afghanistan's neighbors. Israeli authorities approve plans for the construction of more than 3,000 settler units in the occupied West Bank. Plus, the African Union suspends Sudan's membership over the recent military coup as protests demanding civilian rule continue in the country. Warm welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The one-day conference of Afghan neighbors held in the Iranian capital has come to an end. Speaking at a news conference following the event, Iran's foreign minister reiterated Tehran's call for broad-based government in Afghanistan.
An all-inclusive government should be formed in Afghanistan with the participation of all ethnic groups. International legitimacy without domestic acceptability will lead nowhere. All neighboring countries should encourage all Afghan sides to establish a broad-based government.
Hossein Amir Abdullahian added that only an all-inclusive government can bring about unity in Afghanistan. He called for strengthening of a regional approach to bring peace and security to the war-weary nation without foreign interference. The top diplomat noted that Afghan people are bearing the brunt of the U.S. invasion and its 20-year occupation of their country. The foreign ministers of Pakistan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, as well as Russian and Chinese ambassadors, attended the Tehran conference. The Russian and Chinese foreign ministers, as well as UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, virtually addressed the meeting. A correspondent spoke with Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh on the sidelines of the Tehran conference. He told us that the participating countries are pursuing active diplomacy to ensure that Afghanistan will be a peaceful and prosperous nation in the not-too-distant future.
We are in a very critical situation regarding Afghanistan. What is happening right now in Tehran is an attempt by all six neighboring countries of Afghanistan to work together for the peaceful and prosperous Afghanistan in near future. What we are seeing right now in Tehran is an active diplomacy trying to bring together all different factions of thoughts about the future of Afghanistan to clarify what are the main principles that everybody can agree on. We are trying to show that all neighboring countries of Afghanistan can work together for a better better future for Afghanistan, and trying to materialize the will of the people of Afghanistan, whom they are actually subject to this critical situation. What we are seeing right now is the very catastrophic ramifications of United States invasion of Afghanistan, and this irresponsible runaway of the of Washington. What we are doing right now is trying to actually bring together the different players who can actually have an effective role, and Tehran is a place that we hope that we can provide a better ground for the next round, which is going to happen in Beijing soon.
Russia says the U.S. and other Western countries used Afghanistan as a tool for attaining their narrow geopolitical goals. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov made the remarks in a video address to a ministerial meeting of Afghanistan's neighbors held in the Iranian capital. Lavrov stressed that NATO members, including the U.S., are the ones who created Afghanistan's current predicament and should bear responsibility for the country's socioeconomic recovery. Russia's top diplomat also called on Afghanistan's neighbors to prevent the military presence of the U.S. and NATO forces in their territory following their withdrawal from Afghanistan earlier this year.
We call on Afghanistan's neighboring countries not to allow a military presence of U.S. and NATO forces that plan to move there after leaving Afghanistan's territory.
Lavrov also highlighted Moscow's support for the formation of an inclusive government that represents all Afghan national minorities and political forces. He also noted that the Taliban government has a real, although elusive, opportunity to bring Afghanistan back to the global stage as a responsible and peaceful country. The Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi also addressed the conference, saying that the Taliban are eager to have dialogue with the international community. He also called on the world to help Afghanistan's development.
Coordination. We need to increase mutual
Political analyst John Bosnich says the one-day conference of Afghanistan's neighbors represents a good regional initiative to protect the country from foreign intervention.
What I do see as optimistic here is that the regional powers and other nations surrounding Afghanistan have chosen to meet in a very open and friendly way in Iran to plan for a non-interventionist neighborhood. And this can deprive the United States with its foot on the ground in the region. If Pakistan and if other countries decline to assist the American empire in maintaining whatever foothold it might want to extract resources from Afghanistan, then we might see a change. And it's important that the next meeting and this series of meetings that you've started now in Iran is going to continue to China. Because if it is successful, we should be hoping for Chinese financial investment in Afghanistan that could bring economic stability to the country and thereby allow an area of stability in the entire region. I take an optimistic view because I don't accept that the United States can perpetually destroy a region. And I therefore trust that the immense resources that China has, the goodwill that Iran is showing, and the potential assistance even from Russia should be able to shut out the American manipulation of the people and the territory.
Ali Bagheri Khani says that his country is ready to start negotiations before the end of November. Bagheri Khani made the statement in a tweet, noting that the exact date of the talks would be announced in the course of next week. This followed the official's dialogue with European Union Deputy Secretary General Enrique Mora, which he hailed as serious and constructive. The new round of negotiations is the continuation of talks held between April and June in Vienna with the aim of removing anti-Iran sanctions. Tehran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal held multiple rounds of talks during that period. The deal known as the JCPOA was thrown into chaos after Washington's unilateral withdrawal and subsequent imposition of sanctions in 2018. The Lebanese Minister of Information has sharply criticized Saudi Arabia over its war in Yemen. In a newly released interview, George Kordahi said that Yemen's Ansarullah forces are only defending themselves and their country from foreign aggression led by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. He described the Saudi-led military coalition as futile and absurd, stressing that it must be stopped. Regarding the Yemeni army's retaliatory attacks, Kordahi noted that the damage inflicted on the impoverished nation must also be seen as Yemeni people are being targeted by Saudi airstrikes. In response, the Saudi Foreign Ministry summoned the Lebanese ambassador to protest Kordahi's remarks. The African Union suspends Sudan's membership until civilian rule is restored in the country. The AU strongly condemned the military coup in Sudan and slammed the takeover as unconstitutional. The World Bank also suspended aid to Sudan, citing concerns over the recent developments in the country. On Monday, the Sudanese military seized power and declared a state of emergency. Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok was detained but later released under close guard. The head of the country's armed forces, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, said that the military assumed power to avoid a civil war. Protests have been ongoing across the country with demonstrators demanding a return of civilian rule. Several people have been killed during the protests, while security forces have launched sweeping arrests of protesters. Yemeni army has successfully liberated another district capital in the strategic west central province of Ma'arib as the fight against the Saudi-backed forces intensifies in the region. The liberated city Al-Juba is considered the southern gate of Ma'arib province. Yemeni forces also inflicted heavy losses upon the Saudi-backed mercenaries. Abdul Latif al-Bashali has more.
After 48 hours of fierce clashes with the Saudi-led coalition's forces, Yemeni army backed by local tribes managed to take control of the city of Al-Jadid, the capital of Al-Juba district and the strategic province of Ma'arib. In the battles, dozens of the Saudi-led mercenaries were killed and hundreds were forced to surrender.
The liberation of the Al-Juba district has a strategic and military importance. as it is located between Shabwa and Marib. It was the only way out of Marib for the mercenaries of the Saudi-led coalition, but the Yemeni army managed to tighten its grip on this area. Marib is close to falling in the hands of our forces, and the Yemeni army is keen on the safety of the civilians of Marib and the displaced.
Observers say taking control of the city is an important step toward liberation of Marib, as Al-Juba is the southern gate of Marib. As the Yemeni army is moving forward, the leaders of the Saudi-led coalition forces have been ordered to relocate in the eastern province of Sayoun.
The military advancement in the southern areas of Marib narrows the noose around the enemy, especially those located inside the city of Marib. There are large gatherings of Al-Qaeda and other terrorist elements that were brought in to fight the Yemeni army. The enemy forces are trying to reposition themselves in Sayoun. However, the people of Sayoun must reject the presence of these forces.
Since last year, the oil-rich province of Marib has turned into a focus of the Yemeni army's operations as the last stronghold of the coalition forces. So far, the Yemeni troops have succeeded in liberating thousands of square kilometers and encircling the city of Marib from all sides. The Yemeni army has tightened the grip on the Saudi-backed forces in Marib and is just a step away from taking control of the city. Liberating Marib will pave the way for Yemen's armed forces' further operations. Yemeni forces say they will fight until the liberation of all territories. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reporting for Press TV, Sana'a.
Israel is pushing ahead with plans to build over 3,000 settler units in the occupied West Bank. An official with the regime's Ministry for Military Affairs announced the final approval for building 1,800 settler units and the preliminary approval for the construction of over 1,300 more units. The U.S. earlier voiced concern over Israel's decision to move forward with the plans. Palestinian resistance groups have also issued a joint statement warning the Israeli regime against pressing ahead with the settlement construction plans. Jonathan Kutab is a co-founder of the Al-Haq Human Rights Organization, who joins us from Lancaster, PA. Jonathan Kutab, welcome. Taking a look at this news, it's not surprising, but it's, again, international law, which prohibits the building of settlements, is being broken again by Israel, and they are moving forward with this. What is your initial reaction to this?
Well, it is clearly a violation of international law, And it's another clear statement by Israel that it does not wish to be bound by international law. Now, that creates a problem for everyone concerned, I think, because the world cannot afford this kind of lawlessness. The whole point of international law, which really developed tremendously after the Second World War, is that you cannot live in a world which is governed by the rule of the jungle. Whoever is powerful can do whatever they want. We do need rules, we do need laws, we do need principles that govern people's actions. So the building of additional settlements is simply a slap in the face, I think, of the international community.
Indeed. I'd like to test your memory here, if I may, Jonathan Kutab, and I'm going to read a headline off to you. It says, "As Biden visits Israel, Israel unveils plans for new settlements." This headline then in its body goes on to say that hours after the visit of Biden, Israel's Interior Ministry announced 1,600 new housing units for what it calls Jews in East Jerusalem, and that this was clearly a move that embarrassed Biden. This news is from the year 2010, when Biden was the VP. It speaks volumes, and I'm going to mention another thing from this, that Israel does not care, even when the U.S., at that point, VP Biden visited the occupied territories, that it went ahead and makes an announcement when he visits Israel at that point.
That is true. At that time, it was viewed as a slap in the face of the United States itself, as well as the international community, and an embarrassment to them. And I think that the current expansion of settlements is also an embarrassment to the United States, because the Biden administration declared that human rights is one of its the principles which guide its foreign policy. Now, that's very difficult to maintain in light of the behavior of Israel, which is viewed as a close ally for the United States.
As I mentioned, this piece of news was back in 2010, and it says here, at that time, Eli Yishai, the leader of the right-wing Shas party, he was in his capacity, he had made Jewish settlements in East Jerusalem as one of his central causes. So just going back 10 years, we can see that really nothing changes despite all the announcement, despite all the condemnations when it comes to settlements. We can see that Israel just keeps on progressing, one administration after another. And, of course, the U.S., at best, you get condemnations, and that's about it. How do you see U.S.'s role when it comes to Israel, in particular vis-a-vis settlements?
Well, I think the U.S. is in a complex situation. It tries to maintain a rules-based international law. That's what it declares. On the other hand, it is not willing to do the real work of enforcing international law or even holding Israel to any kind of accountability. And I think Israel senses that. And when the governments don't do their work, civil society usually operates. And the six human rights organizations that have recently been declared illegal by Israel have been working very hard with the International Criminal Court to bring some sense of accountability for the war crimes of Israel, including the crime of apartheid and including its behavior during its actions against Gaza, when Gantz himself was in charge of the army. So in a way, Israel is saying not only will we violate international law, but we will punish anybody who tries to hold us accountable. And we'll call them a terrorist organization and bring all sorts of punishments and sanctions against them. And the United States, I think, is in a very embarrassing position with respect to the behavior of Israel, both in the aspect of settlements and with respect to human rights organizations and civil society organizations like Al-Haq.
Thanks for tuning in. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Nearly 700 European firms have financial ties worth $255 billion with businesses actively involved in illegal Israeli settlements, according to a new report from civil society. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Boxbaum, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Report Reveals European Firms Have More Than $255 Billion Entwined in Illegal Israeli Settlements. Stay tuned, please, for the second part of this article. Wilhelm Stays, coordinator of DBIO Coalition, noted, despite the illegal nature of Israeli regime settlements under international law, European financial institutions continue to throw a financial lifeline to companies operating in the settlements. European financial institutions should take up their responsibility and follow the example of KLP and GPFG. They should end all investments and financial flows into Israeli settlements and not buy into Israeli regime occupation. Even with these divestment decisions, however, the aforementioned firms still associate with settlement-entwined businesses. KLP is invested in 8 companies involved in a settlement enterprise: Delta Galil Industries, FIBI, Matrix IT, Mavin Group, Rami Levy Chain Stores, Hashikma Marketing 2006, Shapir Engineering and Industry, and Chaparral. GPFG still has business dealings with 34 companies linked to the illegal Israeli settlements. These businesses are ACS Group, Atlas, Copco, Bank Hapoalim, and Bank Leumi. These ongoing financial relationships put into question the firm's commitment to human rights. Maha Abdullah, one of the co-drafters of the report and the international advocacy officer at Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies, told MinPress News that the DBIO's findings definitely contradict the institution's purported ethical responsibilities. Abdullah said, "These companies and financial institutions claim that they are committed to human rights, but then we see the facts on the ground and the level of their involvement in the settlement. So, clearly, these are all in violation of their responsibilities under international law and towards human rights standards." Al-Haq's Khazir speculated, however, that the slow pullout from the settlement enterprise may stem from fears of political backlash. "We saw how the reaction from the Israeli regime towards Ben & Jerry's decision was," Khazir said, adding, "so some companies would be wary of reputational risk and also see divestment as problematic for their shareholders. It's a process of finding the right balance in terms of their gains and their goals." All 50 companies named in the report participate in at least one of the activities listed by the United Nations as criteria for inclusion in its database of companies operating in the illegal Israeli settlements. Of the 50 companies implicated, 15 are American. These businesses are Airbnb, Booking Holdings, Caterpillar, CETCO Mineral Technology Group, Cisco Systems, CNH Industrial, DXC Technology, Energix, Expedia, etc. More than 600,000 Israelis live in settlements across OPT, and 42% of the West Bank is under settlement control. Area C of the West Bank abounds with natural resources, but 68% of this region is reserved for illegal Israeli settlements, while only 1% is designated for Palestinian use. The continuous settler takeover of Palestinian land has prevented Palestinians from developing and utilizing their resources and therefore significantly depleted their economy. Restricted access to Dead Sea, quarries, and mines has led to an over $1 billion annual loss in revenue for Palestine, according to a 2015 policy brief from Palestinian think tank Al Shabaka. And companies' exploitation of West Bank quarries is estimated at $900 million annually. The DBIO report authors write, "The exploitation of natural resources means that the Palestinian people are denied their right to self-determination and permanent sovereignty over their natural resources. By profiting from the depletion of Palestinian finite quarry resources, individual corporate actors may be held criminally liable for complicity in the crimes of appropriation, environmental destruction, and the pillage of natural resources." The EU provided more than $40 million in humanitarian aid to Palestine in 2021. It also follows international law in declaring the Israeli settlements illegal. Yet the EU is the Zionist regime's largest trade partner, with a total of approximately $36 billion in traded goods last year. Khodair said, explaining that the goals of foreign affairs units often clash with human rights entities in the EU, there are conflicting interests even between different European institutions, each with their own priorities. The EU does not support the UN database on companies complicit in the illegal Israeli settlements and continues to block funding to update their resource over budgetary constraints. Yet again, in contradictory fashion, an EU court also ruled in 2019 that consumers have a right to know if products sold in EU markets were made in illegal Israeli settlements. Abdullah said, "On the one hand, the EU has a very consistent approach and position on the illegality of settlements and all the associated violations that come along with it that undermine Palestinian rights. But at the same time, we are seeing that European businesses and financial institutions are still freely and without any consequences are being involved and active with the settlement enterprise." For Abdullah, European business activity in the settlement seems in a strong contrast to the EU's stated allegiances to the Palestinian cause. Abdullah said, "We know what that means in reality. It means giving them an economic lifeline, allowing them to sustain themselves and expand and grow with time, because these settlements, at the end of the day, rely on money in order to prosper and sustain and expand."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَوْ يُوهُ بِلِيهِ اسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues. Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now let's listen to the speech of Sheikh Jafar Jafar.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that He gives us these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa ta'ala. Our beloved Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him and his family, says, مَثَلُ الْمُؤْمِنِ مَثَلُ السُّنْبُلَ يُحَرِّكُ حَرِّيحْ فَتَكُومُ مَرَّ وَتَقَعَ أُخْرَى. He says the example of a believer is that of a stalk of corn, right? So it's not just the ear where the corn sits in, but it's the whole stalk. You know, here you drive through Caledon and even on King Street and things like that, you see cornfields, right? You see these long corn stalks. This is what is being referred to here. An example of a believer is like that stalk. When the wind, which the wind causes to move, it stands at times and it collapses at other times. وَمَثَلُ الْكَافِرِ. And the example of a non-believer, كَمَثَلِ الْأُرْزَ. The example of a pine or a cedar trunk. لَا تَزَالُ قَائِمَةٌ حَتَّى تَنَقَّلَ. He says that it will always remain firm and standing until it is uprooted by winds. This is a really interesting hadith. Yeah, really interesting. I'll let you read it again. It's written there. It's a really beautiful hadith, one that I believe can be understood in multiple ways, right? So the first way we can understand this hadith is that a believer should be willing and able to bend and make themselves uncomfortable to follow the guidance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In other words, like my ego shouldn't be so firm that I believe that religion should bend around me. Rather, I should be so flexible that my desires can be put aside at times. My desires can be thrown down at times just so that I can fulfill what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants me. There is this hadith that I always love very much from our fifth Imam Al-Baqir alayhi afdalu salatu wassalam, where he's reported to have said, "Inna lanuhibbu an nu'afa fi man nuhib." He says, indeed we desire for ourselves and those that we love to be blessed with well-being, yeah, to have afia. We like that. We have desires, the Imam alayhi salam says. But he says, فَإِذَا جَاءَ أَمْرُ اللَّهِ سَلَّمْنَا فِي مَا يُحِبْ. But when it comes to the command of God, we submit to whatever He loves. That means in those moments, yes, I enjoy my sleep when I finally get to sleep. But when it is time for adhan and the time for fajr, I leave my desires for the desires of what God wants, for the love of Allah. And that is an example of a believer. It's not that, no, this is the time I get up, and this is what I eat, and this is what I do, and if religion doesn't bend my way, that's fine. No, that's not the alama. That's not the sign of a believer. A believer is flexible in that way, where they are willing to put aside their desires for the desires of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Another way that we can understand this tradition is that a believer is also flexible with his or her duties no matter what situation they find themselves in, right? So in the world that we live in, expectations are constantly evolving, norms are constantly changing, and we should never be such who either never compromise, and in that non-compromising harm ourselves, or just change and say, no, I have to live to the standards of society. And so let me explain by giving some examples. So for example, like if I'm at work and I work all day and now the time for salah is earlier, the qadha of Dhuhr and Asr, I should be flexible enough to try to find certain time and certain place to pray, whether it's during my break, whether it's during my lunch. It shouldn't be that I stick to this and say, no, I have to do this. Allah will understand. No, put God first, right? If I travel, I make sure I find food that is approved and suitable to eat, and not that I make certain, it should be okay, Allah understands. None of that, right? Like, my faith is such, Islam is such that it is eternal, right? That it is forever. And obviously, when God assigns or prescribes something for us, He knows what will come, what time will demand for us, what our age that we live in will ask from us. Yet, there's flexibility within Islam, right? And so it's not that I am so firm to say that, no, I can't live in this society. No, we can absolutely live in this society. Nor am I so firm with society to say that religion has to bend. No, Islam in itself, a mu'min will find a way, right, to be flexible and still carry out what they are expected to carry out. And I think that this COVID has taught us that, hasn't it, right? Like, the fact that our mosques came to a halt, right? And certain people may have looked at us to say that, oh, you are weak believers. But this hadith teaches me that, no, we were flexible, right? We still did our azadari. We still did our amal during Ramadan. We still are doing the functions, though it is slightly different. But this slight difference has opened up doors to now where people are connected throughout the world. We have programs on all the time, basically, whoever wants to join something. That's the mark of flexibility that I believe Islam teaches us. That look, you don't just have to do it this way. There is ways and room for maneuver within the boundaries. Not that I create my own boundaries. I don't want confusion from what I'm saying, right? I don't want to say, oh, Sheikh Jaffer said we can just bend and do. No, within the boundaries of Sharia, within the hudud and the guidelines that are set by God, there is room for us to be practicing Muslims, to be practicing believers, firm in our iman, without having to succumb to the different times and the different ages that we live in. That's the second example, I believe, or the second lesson that we can take from this hadith. The third lesson that I believe we can take from this hadith is the fact that believers should be emotionally alive, right? That it's referring to emotions, that we can't just be stoic, we can't just be hard-hearted, we can't just be monotoned or mono-emotioned or anything like that, but rather our hearts cry, we are able to see our mistakes, our hearts are resentful, our hearts are remorseful. When it's time to weep, I can weep. When it's time to smile, I can smile. A believer is not somebody who's just like, no, this is a robotic we have to be. A believer is very much alive and vibrant with their emotions. So you can see the number of beautiful lessons that we can take from this hadith.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mati. وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight.
Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the top House Republican, recently took to social media to warn that Democrats have hatched a dastardly plot. Democrats, he said, want to track every penny you earn so they can then tax you and your family at the maximum possible amount. The article you're about to hear has been published by the New York Times opinion section. The article has been written by Benjamin Applebaum, the lead writer on economics and business for the New York Times editorial board. The piece is titled, "The Rotten Core of the Republican Party." Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the top House Republican, recently took to social media to warn that Democrats have hatched a dastardly plot. Democrats, he said, want to track every penny you earn so they can tax you and your family at the maximum possible amount. Well, yes, Democrats want Americans to pay the full amount they owe in taxes. What doesn't get enough attention is that many Republicans seem not to agree. Resistance to taxation is the rotten core of the modern Republican Party. Republicans in recent decades have sharply reduced the federal income tax rates imposed on wealthy people and big companies. But their opposition to taxation goes beyond that. They are actively aiding and abetting tax evasion. Republicans have hacked away at funding for the Inland Revenue Service, the IRS, over the past decade, enfeebling the agency. When the rich and powerful open loopholes in the tax code, Republicans reliably fight to keep the loopholes open. Indeed, they valorize Americans who find ways to pay less, a normalization of antisocial behavior that may be even more damaging than their efforts at bureaucratic sabotage. Former President Donald Trump's loud and proud declaration that paying very little in taxes makes me smart was just a more brazen articulation of what has become party orthodoxy. The Democratic proposal targeted by Kevin McCarthy in the video he posted online, he actually calls it un-American, would make it harder for wealthy people to cheat on their taxes. The Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, estimated in 2019 that Americans conceal from taxation more than half of income that is not subject to some form of third-party verification, like a W-2, the form that the government uses to verify ordinary wage income. This blind spot costs the federal government hundreds of billions of dollars in unpaid taxes. In comparison, more than 95% of wage income is reported. Under the current version of the Democrats' plan, which is part of the Biden administration's sweeping Build Back Better legislation, banks would be required to submit annual reports on accounts with total inflows and outflows exceeding $10,000, excluding paychecks and government benefits. The banks would report the total amount deposited in the account and the total amount withdrawn. There would be no reporting of individual transactions. The information would give the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, a better chance to catch cheaters, and it would provide a salutary reminder for people to pay what they owe. The Biden administration recently cemented an international agreement to establish a 15% global minimum tax on corporate income. The long-sought deal would reduce the incentive for American firms to evade taxation by pretending to generate revenue in low-tax havens like Ireland and roughly half of the islands in the Caribbean, a practice that has become all but business as usual in industries with intangible products like finance, technology, and pharmaceutical research. The minimum corporate tax, like the bank reporting requirement, is not aimed at increasing what is owed. It is aimed at collecting what is owed already. Improving tax collection was another important benefit. Democracy and capitalism rest on a lacework of mutual obligation. People fulfill their own responsibilities because they're confident others will too. Collecting taxes, especially from the rich and powerful, is an affirmation of that faith. Felicia Wong, the president of the Roosevelt Institute, a progressive think tank based in New York, said that the corporate tax agreement, which includes 136 countries, is valuable as a demonstration that governments have the ability to impose their will on multinational corporations in the service of the public interest. A hopeful model for confronting other problems like climate change. It can and should create more faith in governance, she said. Both plans, however, must overcome the united opposition of congressional Republicans. The Republican Party was reborn in the 1970s under the banner of resistance to taxation, led by anti-tax men like Jack Kemp and Ronald Reagan. It remains the party's fixation, the one major area of policy on which congressional Republicans were able to agree upon during the Trump administration. By way of ideological justification, Republicans like to talk about liberty, by which they mean a narrow and negative kind of freedom from civic duty and mutual obligation. But the fervent opposition to taxation has always found its deeper wellsprings of motivation in concern about how the money will be spent. In the bellwether case of California, the rise of anti-tax activism was inextricably intertwined with the decline of a white electoral majority. It wasn't a question of whether Americans should ever be required to help one another. The real question was, who would be helped? Opposition to progressive income taxation also draws strength from an imagined democratic ideal in which the people who vote for taxation, pay the taxes, and get the benefits are all one and the same. History tells a very different story, though. From the outset, taxation in the United States was designed as an antidote to inequality. The government initially chose to raise revenue through tariffs, collecting from wealthy merchants. The introduction of a federal income tax in the early 20th century was a different means to the same end. In a historical analysis published last year, a pair of German political scientists, Laura Zielkopf and Hannah Leeser, showed that progressive taxation is a hallmark of democratic governance. Political philosophers have long fretted that democracy allows the poor to plunder the rich. Your opposite has proved more nearly true. Progressive taxation is not a threat to the wealthy. it is a small price to pay for prosperity. Cutting taxes to stop social programs is, by itself, a threat to the sustainability of the American experiment in multicultural democracy. In enabling resistance to lawful taxation, Republicans are engaged in an even more direct assault on democracy. Having failed to constrain government spending through the democratic process, they are seeking to undermine government itself. Representative Kevin McCarthy is right to frame a fairly technical change in tax rules as an issue that goes to the heart of American democracy. Democracies impose higher taxes than other forms of government because democracies are communities of common purpose. We create and maintain our society through our contributions. Or we don't, and things fall apart.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September the 2nd, 2021. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. All praises due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, especially the one remaining with God on earth. You are very welcome, dear brothers. I congratulate all of you for the blessing to be present in the main centers of serving the people. God the Exalted has bestowed on you the blessing to be present in the main centers of serving the country, the nation, and the Islamic Republic. You should appreciate the value of this blessing. I also wish to thank the Islamic Consultative Majlis for having carried out its duties on time. I hope that this will be a good and auspicious beginning for you and the country. Government Week is ornamented with the names of Shahid Rajai and Shahid Bahonar. In other words, it is ornamented with the name and remembrance of martyrdom. God's mercy be upon those two great, outstanding and active men who were blessed with martyrdom. They truly intended to serve.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Although their term of service was short, they showed that they had entered the arena with purity and with the intention of rendering services. They had an Islamic, popular and jihadi mentality. This is a lesson for all existing officials. You, dear brothers, have accepted your responsibility in a difficult time. I hope that God will help you. I too pray, and I hope that you succeed. These are difficult circumstances considering the high rate of inflation, the people's livelihood problems, the issue of coronavirus, and the various other problems that exist. If on the one hand you work in a diligent, untiring, and round-the-clock way, and if you rely on God the Exalted as a reserve and as an investment, you will definitely win and succeed, and you will overcome problems. You should make your intentions divine. And divine intention in this position of yours means having the intention to serve the people. If you enter the field with the genuine intention of serving the people, this is a divine and pure intention, one that will become blessed by God.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.